Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, September 17th, 2001. This evening in the fireside room is John DeGraff. Today's session number is DGJ2001-01, and it's titled Elder Hostel, Television and Social Change, The Courage of Their Convictions. Let's listen in.
And get started here. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm John DeGraff, and I know the folks in the Elder Hostel know that because I've been introduced to you, but I think there's some folks here who weren't part of the Elder Hostel. This is my second year at Holden Village. I was here during the regular summer program last summer and had a wonderful time, and was very eager to be invited back, and was for Elder Hostel this year, so I'm thrilled to be here again and to see all of you and to show you some bits of films that I've made over the years hopefully provoke a discussion. This particular series of screenings is around different themes, and tonight's theme, The Courage of Their Convictions, is really about people who have stuck their necks out, in a sense, to make a difference in the world. And tomorrow night, our theme is called Stewards of Creation, and it's about environmentalists and people who are really taking care of the earth, and some of it even focuses on this particular area of the North Cascades. On Wednesday night, the focus is really poverty and social justice, and in some ways, American policy around the world as it contributes or doesn't contribute to social justice. On Thursday night, the programs will look at issues of food, agriculture, and world hunger. And on Friday, I may just show one film in its entirety, Affluenza, which has been my most popular film over the years, which is, as you might guess, a film about overconsumption, consuming too much, and sort of seeing that as a social disease. But I want to say that I've been making films for about 25 years now, and actually got started because I liked watching documentaries. I was a sociology major in college and actually didn't study film at all, but I liked watching documentaries, but I was always a little alarmed that so many of the documentaries I saw, which were about very important social problems and did a good job of looking at those problems, always left me feeling helpless, that there was really gloom and doom and not much sense that anybody could do anything about it. And what I wanted to do over the course of my years of filmmaking is to inspire people to believe that they really can make a difference, and to tell stories of people who have taken on some of these problems, not put their heads in the sand like an ostrich, but really gone out and tried to do something. And they didn't always succeed, or they only partially succeeded, but I believe they've all made an important difference, and their lives and their work can inspire all of us. And it so happens that among the first people whose stories I made television programs about happened to be Lutheran churchwomen, very active Lutheran churchwomen. And this wasn't, it was purely accidental. I mean, I was looking for good stories of people making a difference. I wasn't looking for Lutherans, Catholics, whatever. But in one of the first programs I made back in 1982, I was interested in the farm crisis, the family farm crisis, which I saw happening. I moved actually to Seattle from Minnesota and actually started my television work with KTCA, some of you are familiar with Channel 2 in Minneapolis, and then since then have been with the public station in Seattle now for 19 years. But I happened to make a film about three Minnesota farm women who were fighting to save their family farms in the farm crisis of the 80s. And the first of them was a very active Lutheran church woman named Ann Canton, who some of you may know, and whose husband was also actually worked for the Lutheran Church. And Ann later became the Assistant Commissioner of Agriculture in the state of Minnesota. But I'm going to show you a little bit of that program. The program had the sort of bizarre title of Dairy Queens, which was actually two of the women were dairy farmers. Ann was not. And this was a joke. The truth behind this was, and it's the only thing Ann and the other women didn't like about the show. We were looking for a title for the show, and we were talking with PBS about this nationally, and one of us said Dairy Queens as a joke. We had never had any intention to do that, and PBS, oh, that'd be great. Yeah, you should do that, you know, make it that. So it ended up being called Dairy Queens, which I have had many mea culpas about, and asked Anne and Alice Tripp, one of the other women, to forgive me about many times. But anyway, I'm going to show you a clip from Dairy Queens about Ann Canton's development as an activist and how she came to be a committed political activist for family farming.
Breakfast is ready anytime.
Okay, I'm on the E10 right now. It'll be about 5 minutes.
Okay, we'll be ready.
Ann and Chuck Canton grow wheat, barley, soybeans, and sugar beets in western Minnesota. Three generations of Cantons have plowed this ground.
Good morning. Are you freezing?
Yes, it's cold.
Ann and Chuck know their land intimately and treat it with loving care. They hope their son, Kent, the oldest of their three children, can keep farming here. The Cantons took the advice of experts who said expand for the coming boom in agriculture. They bought more land and bigger machines, but expansion was not the answer. They are hardworking, efficient, productive farmers, but they are going deeper into debt.
After farming on this farm for some over 20 years, Chuck and I looked at one another and realized, you know, there is something wrong. There is something wrong. Is it us? And are we just doing everything wrong on this place? Or what's happening to us in our small town and to some of our neighbors?
Seed, fuel, fertilizer, machinery, credit. The Cantons' costs have tripled in the past 10 years. They spend more than $6 to produce a bushel of wheat, but at harvest must sell it for less than $4. A few giant grain companies dominate the market. The only choice the Cantons have is to sell or wait, hoping for a higher price. But for them, farming is more than a business. It's a way of life. So even though their economic losses mount, they go deeper into debt, mortgaging their land for the cash to keep farming.
Not very long ago, Chuck had to go and borrow money to pay the interest on the borrowed money. And I know he looked at the banker and said, you know, he began to wonder, you know, are we the only ones that are going through this? And the banker just laughed. And he said, there are many, many, many.
As long as land values rose, farmers survived. But land prices are falling now, and credit is drying up. Every week, more than 100 Minnesota family farms must sell out or face foreclosure. The Cantons know they are living on borrowed time.
$60, $50, $60, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60, $50, $60,
an option is not easy for farmers to watch. In the past 30 years, they have said goodbye to more than half of their neighbors. But not since the Great Depression have so many auctions come so often. So many lives been changed forever. So many dreams died so suddenly.
Sold the tractor $15,200. What number 110 by
you? It's just so wrong, I think, for this nation that expects all the abundance and all the good things in the supermarkets and in the stores, and yet that the people who are here and doing it and working the 12, the 14, maybe 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, can't make it. Moses through the burning bush, he said, I realize the suffering that your people are going through in Egypt. And he said, Moses, go to Pharaoh. That's where the military and the political decisions are made. And what that little story says to me is that we indeed have a responsibility to challenge the pharaohs.
Tom says that we could get all this business settled real quick if we get 5,000 women armed with a rolling pin and send them to Washington, D.C.
In 1977, Anne and a small group of farm women heard about a new farm organization, the American Agriculture Movement.
The whole thrust and idea was that we can do something about it ourselves. And it's at the point where we have to do something, that we can no longer rely on the experts. If we want to survive on this land, it's up to the people of the land to do it.
They began to organize meetings, small at first, but larger as farmers heard that others were demanding a fair price and a living wage.
It just got more exciting, and we got to the point where we were organized enough to put together a march on the Capitol in St. Paul. Because I never protested bodily ever to say that I, as a farmer, was protesting. It was scary for me, but it was also terribly exciting. And the next step then was to say something nationally. We arrived at Washington early in the morning, found our way to Capitol Hill, finally found a place to park, walked for blocks, came around the corner of the capital of the United States and saw 40,000 farmers. I cried. Couldn't believe it. I remember how good that was for Chuck. Because he grabbed me and he said, we aren't the only ones.
Hello. I've been talking to them senators way down that road. Said I'm tired of all your lies, bribes, and corporate ties. I've been doing some hard traveling alone.
A year later, in January 1979, they were back, this time with their tractors. They demanded federal policies that would guarantee a fair price for farm products and the survival of the family farm.
We found out that we could walk into senators' offices and congressmen's offices, and we could talk to them. We knew what the issues were, and we could say it straight and strong, and hopefully get them to understand. And of course, they didn't understand. But Moses had to go many times. It was the 10th time that Pharaoh finally agreed, and he said, go, take your people. Maybe it's unpredictable. Maybe something will happen.
And I'll be happy to take any comments or answer any questions after each of these segments, or to go on and show a couple more and take questions together, whatever your preference is. So. Anybody has any burning questions now? Happy, yes.
What were the effects of this,
of the
demonstration?
Well, I don't think they were, I mean, clearly the problem still continued, and then other economic changes made things better for a while, and it's kind of, the situation for family farmers overall in America, though, is still very difficult. And very grim. We are still losing tremendous amounts of farms and seeing consolidation into larger farms. But, you know, I think Ann, of course, as I mentioned, was later chosen as Assistant Commissioner of Agriculture in Minnesota, and tried to put in practice some things that would make a difference. And I'm saying this honestly, not the people whose stories you will see here didn't always win, but I think they all had some kind of positive impact, and that's what I want to inspire.
Wasn't the tractor market largely a failure, and they were ignored?
Well, they were, they were to a great degree ignored, and that's true.
It's sad.
Right. I mean, we just really don't seem to, and I'll talk about this more on Thursday night, because the whole session is about kind of food and agriculture. It seems like we don't pay a lot of attention in this country to the most basic thing, and the people who provide it for us. You know, the food and the land and so forth, there just seems to be very little concern.
Was that widely broadcast?
Yes, it was broadcast nationwide on the PBS system. Yeah. I think all of these films were broadcast nationwide on PBS. The second clip I'm going to show you is from a film called Mother of the Year. And the story behind this is that shortly after finishing, and these are older films, later in the week I'll be showing more of my most recent documentaries, but these were films done in the early to mid and late 80s. And when I finished Dairy Queens in 1982, I was living out in Seattle, and I was looking for a story there. And at that time in Seattle, the most significant event that was really taking place and calling lots of people's attention to the Seattle area was the coming of the first Trident nuclear submarine to the Bangor submarine base outside Seattle. And this was a time, as you remember, when there was a lot of emphasis about the possibility of nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union. And there was efforts to freeze nuclear arms and many peace marches and protests and so forth. And I had been out, I was very interested in this issue, and I kind of wanted to get to find a way that I could tell this Trident story through a person, through somebody who was concerned about it and doing something about it. And I went out to the base and to the protests and to the place called Ground Zero, which was a community of people who were planning a major protest of the submarine. And I found that the most of the folks were very, I mean, they were wonderful people. I dearly loved them, but they were very counterculture. And I felt that their message would not come across very well to a mainstream American television audience. And I was looking for somebody who would be able to speak to average Americans. And it so happened, I read a little story in the Seattle Times, and it said that a 78-year-old former national U.S. Mother of the Year from Minnesota and a pillar of the Lutheran Church was coming out to Seattle, and she was going to go out in a small boat and get arrested in the blockade of the Trident submarine. And her son happened to be a Lutheran minister in Seattle. His name is John Nelson. Her name, and I'm sure many of you have heard of her, is Ruth Youngdahl Nelson. And so I contacted John Nelson and soon after met his mother. And the more I got to know her, the more I believed that, in fact, she was the perfect person to tell this story. The last person that you would expect, maybe in light of her background, would be out there, you know, risking life and risking jail and feeling so strongly about this nuclear issue. So I'm just going to show you the first part of the documentary Mother of the Year, which is the story of Ruth Youngdahl Nelson and her fight against nuclear arms. Lights again.
She was a dancer. It always surprises people when they tell them that I'm an accused felon. That monster of death, 2 football fields long, my friends, 4 stories high.
In the news, the nation's first Trident submarine, the Ohio, and her crew received a rousing welcome today to their home port of Bangor, Washington. Here, the Ohio will be armed with 24 missiles, each carrying multiple nuclear warheads, a deterrent force more deadly than the explosive power used in all of World War II.
The ship will see the country through the hard years ahead, providing strategic deterrent to nuclear war, and will do the job in magnificent fashion.
But earlier today, the Ohio met a different welcome from dozens of tiny protest boats attempting to block its path. It was a David and Goliath confrontation. The demonstrators were routed by water cannons and rifle-toting Coast Guardsmen. Among those arrested was a former American Mother of the Year.
You have the right to say no to your country, and if you love your country, you'll say no. Even as if you love your child, you say no to something they ask for when it isn't good for them, won't you?
Gundahl Nelson, an unlikely accused felon. She's 80 years old and the widow of a minister. One of her brothers was a governor. Another was a congressman. Only 10 years ago, she herself was honored as America's National Mother of the Year. But today, she's a lawbreaker, an outspoken critic of nuclear weapons. This is the story of an unusual woman and her remarkable family. Ruth was the ninth of 10 children born to Swedish immigrants, Elizabeth Gundahl, and her husband, John, a Minneapolis grocer.
Our home was open to everybody. Hospitality was shown to peg leg John, who thumped down 11th Avenue each spring. And my mother would put a white tablecloth on the table and feed him as if he were a king.
Ruth first asserted her independent spirit here at Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota. As a student athlete, she starred in basketball, football, and tennis. 60 years later, her accomplishments are still remembered.
It's my great pleasure to present to you the first woman inducted into the Gustavus Adolphus College Athletic Hall of Fame, Ruth Gundahl Nelson.
Today, a serious heart condition keeps Ruth off the basketball court, but she still gets plenty of exercise.
I swim each day and try to keep active as much as I can. Until 2 years ago, I water skied.
Ruth Gundahl met Clarence Nelson, a Lutheran minister, in a three-mile swimming race. She won, and he proposed. In 1932, they...
Was she convicted? No, actually. The charges ended up being dropped against the protesters. Yes.
So with your documentaries, are they things that you did and presented to PBS? Are they things they commissioned you to do? I mean, what's the working relationship there?
They commissioned very little.
I was going to say.
although in the case of Dairy Queens, they commissioned that. The first one, the AMCAP one, was funded by public television, by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Ruth Gundahl Nelson one was not funded by
And was it shown?
Public broadcasting. Yes, it was, but it was clearly a much more controversial topic in a way. And it was funded by, it's a sort of an interesting story. It was funded by the State Humanities Commissions of Minnesota and Washington State. And I'll tell you that this actually leads into the next film. At that time, the State Humanities Commissions, as some of you may know, received their funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the NEH. And of course, this was 1983-84. And at that time, the head of the National Endowment for the Humanities was a fellow named William Bennett. Many of you have probably heard of him. He later became the Secretary of Education and then the Drug Czar. Remember the Drug Czar. William Bennett he did most things that were funded by the humanities he never saw because most of them weren't considered controversial. But if a show was considered controversial and if his staff people who had seen it were not thrilled, it went on for Mr. Bennett to see. And so of course I've gotten this third or fourth hand, but Bill Bennett did see Mother of the Year. And I'm told that when he saw it, his words were, "This is not humanities. This is sophisticated anti-nuclear propaganda." I, of course, was pleased that he said it was sophisticated. but it had some ramifications. I mean, he didn't stop the film from being made, but I was in the process then of making the next film, which you will see a clip from. And it was going to be funded by the Washington Commission for the Humanities. In fact, they had given me money to develop the film. They were on the verge of funding. and when this explosion with them occurred. And they immediately got cold feet and decided not to fund the next film, which actually it turned out they could have easily funded because it wasn't controversial at all in the same way, and in fact received some great critical response even from very conservative people. But the subject, I happened to learn from a friend in 1984 that Bainbridge Island, Washington, across the sound from Seattle, where I live, was the first place from which Japanese Americans were taken during World War II after the bombing of Pearl Harbor and sent to so-called relocation centers or relocation camps east of the on the mountains and in the desert. And they were the only people who were taken completely as a race. I mean, there was no attempt to find out whether individuals might be possibly commit espionage or anything. If you were of Japanese ancestry, you had to go. You were removed from your home and taken there. And there was at that time an outpouring of hate and hostility toward Japanese Americans following Pearl Harbor. It involved many ugly incidents, some of which we're seeing again in the newspaper in response to the World Trade Center attacks. I noticed that in Phoenix, for instance, a couple of nights ago, an Indian man who owned a convenience store was shot and killed by someone who thought that he was an Arab. And in Seattle, there were frequent incidents, and up and down the West Coast, for instance, of attacks on, before they were sent to the camps, on Japanese Americans, but also in the city of Seattle, a Chinese man was killed because people thought he was Japanese American. And you had this kind of thing that happens where a whole group of people is blamed for the actions of a few, and something I think we've learned somewhat from, because at least our national leaders now are not calling for this kind of thing. In 1942, they were, and they were calling for the removal of Japanese Americans. There was on the West Coast only one newspaper, a small newspaper, the newspaper in Bainbridge Island, who actually, where the newspaper actually spoke out and said, this is wrong, it shouldn't be done. These people haven't done anything wrong and their civil rights are being violated. Only one paper. And the story that you will see a little bit of here is the real story behind the very popular novel and later film called Snow Falling on Cedars, which some of you may have read. I'm sure you've heard of it. It takes place a few years later, but the Sam Shepard character in the film, if you saw the film, is the Walt Woodward who is in the documentary that I made in 1985 about the situation. And the one publisher, one editor on the West Coast who stood up and said, no, this is wrong. So I'm going to show you a little bit of the documentary Visible Target about the evacuation of Japanese Americans from Bainbridge Island in World War II.
Asian Americans had endured years of racial and legal discrimination.
I still felt like I was a second-class citizen because we were denied so many things. We could not work, for instance, at the Navy Yard or Boeing or join some of the unions.
Have you ever watched a well-trained monkey at a zoo? Have you seen how carefully he imitates his trainer? The monkey goes through so many human movements so well that he actually seems to be human. But under his fur, he's still a savage little beast. Now, consider the imitative little Japanese.
War hysteria. Japanese victories in the Pacific bring nightmares of invasion. Bainbridge boys begin dying on distant battlefields. National leaders and much of the popular media failed to distinguish between the enemy and Americans of Japanese ancestry. Responding, Japanese Americans tried desperately to demonstrate their loyalty.
We disposed of everything that was Japanese, magazines and books, records. What we could burn, we burned, and what we could bury, we buried.
It didn't matter. At first, radical white supremacy groups, and eventually almost everyone on the West Coast, demanded the removal of all Japanese from coastal areas. But Walt and Millie Woodward felt differently. They were publishers of a weekly newspaper, the Bainbridge Review. The night after Pearl Harbor, they stayed up late to print an extra edition. They asked their readers to remember that the island Japanese had nothing to do with the bombing.
The aim was to prevent hysteria, panic.
But the FBI rounds up hundreds of Japanese-born people suspected of loyalty to their mother country. Agents raid Bainbridge Island homes.
They saw my father pull to the corner and pray. And he said, "This is my country. This is my adopted country. I haven't done anything wrong. And God knows that."
Those arrested are not charged with any crime, but are sent to detention camps anyway. Dynamite for blasting stumps, shotguns for shooting crows. The agents take them too, plus cameras and radios. These could be used to help the enemy, they say.
Okay, who's hacking the ball then?
Hisa Matsudaira was younger than the children she now teaches when the agents came and her mother told her her father had been taken away to prison.
I remembered the dress she had on and she was crying. And that was the first time I ever saw my mother cry. And the only prisons that I knew were criminal prisons. And I couldn't figure out why they had taken her and put him in prison.
Even the FBI roundup failed to quiet West Coast demands for removal. Several government investigations had confirmed the overwhelming loyalty of Japanese Americans, but Army officers believed that an espionage net, including Japanese Americans, was already active. President Roosevelt was urged to remove all persons of Japanese ancestry from coastal areas. The president, supported by Congress, complied. Virtually the entire West Coast press supported the action. But not the Woodwards.
Anybody who has ever bothered to read the Bill of Rights knows that that's a clear violation of that Bill of Rights. There was no court ordered, no warrants issued.
Bainbridge Japanese Americans were the first uprooted by the Army. On March 23rd, signs went up on the island ordering the evacuation of all Japanese, aliens and citizens alike, within a week. The government made no arrangements to protect their farms and businesses. Walt and Millie Woodward were angry. Week after week, they had advocated tolerance and justice for island Japanese American citizens. But theirs was a lonely voice.
We were accused at times of being Jap lovers.
There are many people that felt sympathetic towards our position, but very few of them came up out front and became a visible target like we did.
Review editorials drew fire from readers, and the paper lost advertising and subscriptions. But the Woodwards stood firm.
If it could happen to Japanese Americans, it can happen to Scottish Americans or Italian Americans or Rotary Club Americans or fat Americans or skinny Americans.
Come on, Fishy.
Shigeko Kitamoto had only a week to prepare to leave her home. She would be allowed to take with her just what she could carry. Her husband was in a detention camp. She had four small children and so many things to take care of.
Good night.
Myrtle Norman has been Mrs. Kitamoto's friend for 50 years. When the evacuation order came, she offered to help Shigeko get ready.
I says, well, I'm going to be left behind and you're going to be taking care of him, is what I said. Trying to cheer her up, I just didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to relieve her mind with four little babies.
She always take care of my children and just kind of pick me up. And she was real nice to me.
Some Bainbridge neighbors helped the Japanese by storing property and by assuming management of farms and businesses. But not everyone was so generous.
We had other people come, wanted to buy our refrigerator and washing machine and so on. And they offered a pittance, and I said, I'm not selling.
Students knew evacuation was coming. At Bainbridge High School, a quarter of them were of Japanese ancestry. They were class officers and star athletes. An integrated Bainbridge baseball team played its final game just before evacuation. Walt Woodward remembers seeing the team's Japanese-American catcher after the game.
He was very dejectedly walking, I guess, to the locker room or something, and somewhere out of nowhere, a very beautiful blonde girl, a student at the high school, audibly crying, ran after this catcher, threw her arms around the whole mess, player and chest protector, kissed him, and ran off crying.
March 30th, the evacuation begins.
There was no way we could fight it. How could 272 Japanese on the island fight a company of army soldiers? And, you know, more than one soldier had tears in his eyes.
Everything is abandoned at gunpoint. Japanese are brought to the Bainbridge ferry dock, where their friends have come to say goodbye.
My whole class and the classes prior to mine and behind me, younger than I was, were there. And they were just devastated.
We called the buses down and we were holding their hands and everybody was crying.
Just imagine your good friends being kind of herded on the ferry.
Just like they're treating them like a bunch of cattle.
To be marched under those conditions with the soldiers, with the bayonets and everything else, that was one of the most humiliating experiences I've ever gone through.
In Seattle, the Japanese are led to a waiting train.
When they were going down through Seattle, well, we spotted them, we ran after the train, and we were all crying and waving goodbye to them. I was a paratrooper in the Pacific, and I fought the Japanese, but these kids here still, you know, my real good friends, and they always were. And I mean, it was, you were fighting a war with different Japanese people. I mean, it was just different somehow.
It took 2 days for the islanders to reach their destiny.
Any questions or
say something about the process or the method or how you go about putting all this together? Are you all alone?
No, but I mean, I don't do the camera work, for instance. I do the editing, I do write the script, and someone else reads the narration. And I do the interviewing of the subjects and the directing of the camera, and kind of think about what I want to put into this. And I help with research. Of course, I don't do the music. So it is, any kind of documentary like this is very much a team effort. A lot of people are involved in the making of any program like this. I should mention that we TV people are often accused of sort of trying to squeeze every ounce of emotion out of people that we can, and put them on the air in that way. But in this particular program, in the making of this, and in the case particularly of Hisa Matsudaira, the woman who you saw with the football, and who was crying and who's about her father. It was an interesting situation because I interviewed her quite some time in her living room, and her young children were actually watching the entire interview. And she said that she had never told them about this. In fact, this was a very common thing. It's not so common anymore, but in the early 1980s still, there were many Japanese Americans who still felt shame about this whole incident and didn't even tell their children that it had happened. And so she was telling this story, and her kids were like wide-eyed, just kind of like she'd saying about having the only time she'd seen her mother cry, and her kids were having precisely the same experience at the same time, and they were just like shocked. And we tried, I mean, she literally sobbed through the entire interview, and I was actually trying, because some of it you couldn't understand, and so I was really trying to get back and take topics that go back to sort of questioning that would be a little bit away from that. And a couple of times I said, well, you know, I really feel badly about this because I know it hurts, and you know, if you want to stop, we can stop. And she said, no, you know, I really want to get this off my, I want to say it. And then I wondered too, and that was fine then. And then I wondered after she saw the program, actually on television, whether then she might feel bad that, you know, that I used her. And in every scene that she's in the film, she saw it. And so I saw her afterwards, and I said, Hisa, I hope you weren't upset that there's so much of you in the film. Crying, and she said, well, no, at first I was, but then now I know it's like a catharsis for me. I finally got this out and was able to say it. And part of it is that she never reconciled with her father. She always thought as a kid that he had been a criminal. She never understood this, and he died right after the war. This was fairly common of many of the Japanese men, the Issei first generation who came, that the loss of face for them and being sent off and taken away from their families and things. And so for a young child who's five and in a culture that rarely talked about these things, her father died before she ever knew really what had happened. So all of this was obviously a very, very emotional experience for her. For me and for the other people who were making it. I heard many of these kinds of stories.
Was it the rule that the families were separated then, that the adult males were held separately from their families?
If they were born in Japan, yes. All the adult males who were born in Japan were first taken away before, and they were taken to these special detention centers where they were questioned for a long period of time. And then they were sent to rejoin their families in the camps.
What was the Washington reaction when the film came out? Mr. Bennett, et cetera.
I don't know what Bennett's reaction to this one was, but I got the best review of it I've ever received in the New York Times for any film I got for this particular film. And the review was by a guy named John Corey, who was a probably the most right-wing television critic in the country. His wife was actually an official in the Reagan administration. And he wrote a review of it saying that, you know, this was a moving lesson in American history in a wonderfully done program, that everyone should see it, and so forth. So I think by that time, even regardless of the political spectrum, I think people had started to begin to realize that this was not something our a period in our country's history that we could be proud of. Anything else on that? Okay, I've got just a couple more. This next one is quite short. This film, I found out about an organization in 1987 that actually made it, its whole work was like honoring the kind of people that I did stories about. It was an organization based on Whidbey Island in Washington State called the Giraffe Project. And the purpose of the Giraffe Project was to honor people who stick their necks out for the common good. So hence the idea of being a giraffe. And they had many stories, and I did a documentary for PBS about this project and featured about eight of the giraffes in the documentary itself. And one of the stories that had just come up and was still somewhat in process at the time we made the documentary was the story of the Aryan Nations in Idaho, northern Idaho, and their racist campaign by Reverend Richard Butler at that time, and that included attacks on people who spoke out against them. And one of those people, the most active leader of the opposition to the Aryan Nations in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, was a Catholic priest named Bill Wasman. And he was given this giraffe award. And so I profiled him as one of the people in the story. This is a little bit of the story of Bill Wasman's fight against the Aryan Nations. Okay.
Father Bill Wasmuth lives in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. It's a western resort town, small, friendly, and traditional. But a few years ago, the peace and quiet here were shattered. They came to northern Idaho calling for an all-white nation in the Pacific Northwest. Aryan Nations, a racist organization, made Coeur d'Alene its headquarters.
Initially, the community reaction was to just let them be, live and let live, that kind of a philosophy. But then we found out very quickly that such inaction was interpreted by both the Aryans and by the rest of the country as being tacit support, if not active support.
When Aryans began harassing minorities in Coeur d'Alene, concerned citizens formed a task force to defend human rights. As leader of the task force, Father Bill became a symbol of resistance to racism.
I thought that we would be safe because the Aryans would figure out that if they attacked any of us at all, that it would just galvanize the community against them. Unfortunately, we gave them too much credit for thinking.
In 1986, a series of bombings rocked the town of Coeur d'Alene. The first bomb went off here at Bill Wasmuth's house. If he'd been in his kitchen instead of his living room, it might have killed him.
I will consider it KRUWA.
Bill was afraid, but he refused to back down.
I stayed in my house that night, and I stayed in my house the next night, and never left.
The community was watching very much on how I responded to this thing, and if I responded in a great deal of fear, they would end up with a lot of fear and panic as well. I didn't want that to happen.
It didn't happen. The citizens of Coeur d'Alene rallied around Father Bill and the task force, leaving the Aryans alone and defeated.
People really are, their hearts are in the right place on this issue. The community is very anxious to to be a model community in terms of openness to all peoples of all races, creeds, and colors. Make a difference in your world.
Lights, please.
Want to be a giraffe? Okay.
And Bill Wasserman actually ended up leading the priesthood and has been for many years the head of a head of an organization fighting this kind of thing based in Seattle, National Anti-Harassment or something. I can't remember the name, but anyway. He took that on as his life's work.
He has moved to Central Washington. He has MS now and is not able to do any more. I saw him speak in Richland in the spring, and he said that would be his last public appearance because the MS was affecting his speech and his ability to walk.
Oh, I haven't seen him for a number of years. I'm very sorry to hear that.
We all know what happened to the Aryan Nation. They were sued and they lost their compound.
Right. So
yes.
Your Aryan Nation got a home.
What did he say?
He said that the Aryan Nation's really recently lost a major lawsuit within their property in Idaho and so forth. From a family that they had harassed.
There's another very wealthy man in Sandpoint who is funding Butler now.
Ah.
Apparently he's a Californian who made a lot of money, I don't know, in high tech or something, and has moved to Sandpoint and purchased a home for Butler after he lost the compound.
These things don't seem to go away, and I think in the light of this week's activities and some of the things we've seen happen and heard about in the newspaper, realize that this sort of bigotry is still ever present among us. The last clip I'm going to show is very different from what you've seen before. It's a story of a different kind of courage, and it's a story about scientists in what was then the Soviet Union. And I'm not going to tell you what happens here, but I will introduce this, saying that this was part of a film I did called Genetic Time Bomb. And it's a film about the loss of biodiversity in agriculture, in seeds particularly around the world, and the dangers that loss has for our ability in the future to feed ourselves, to find the kinds of crop varieties that we can breed with others to solve plant diseases and plant pests and so forth. And the story starts with a story about a famous Russian scientist whose name we never here in the United States, but is probably in the 1930s, he was the leading geneticist in the world. He's certainly the leading scientist in world history in terms of agriculture and plant breeding and so forth. A man named Nikolai Vavilov, who later ended up essentially losing his life in Stalin's purges. But I'm going to show you, this is about an 8-minute clip, the first part is really about this Vavilov's work to save seeds and his understanding of how important it was to save all these varieties of crops that were being lost as we went to a very few varieties that produced the most. And then it's the story of an act of tremendous heroism during World War II by Russian scientists who worked with him in the preserving of the world seeds.
St. Isaac Square, St. Petersburg, Russia. In this building, the science of crop genetic diversity was born. This is the office where Nikolai Vavilov worked for more than two decades. As director of the prestigious Soviet Institute of Plant Industry, Vavilov believed that diverse collections of seeds were needed to improve crop breeding programs. Beginning in 1916, he gathered seeds and tubers the world over in wild places where few Westerners had ever been before. Harsh deserts, rugged mountains, thick jungles. Vavilov and his assistants collected nearly 200,000 varieties of crops. At St. Petersburg, then called Leningrad, Vavilov established the world's first seed bank to store and grow out his collections. In 1926, he published his groundbreaking work, Studies on the Origin of Cultivated Plants. Vavilov argued that each of the world's crops, no matter how widely they are now grown, were originally domesticated in eight separate centers of origin. For example, the center of origin for corn was Central America. For wheat, the Middle East. For potatoes, the Andes. And for rice, Southeast Asia. Perhaps more importantly, Vavilov discovered that one was likely to find the most diversity for a crop in its center of origin, since it was there that the crop had evolved longest with climate changes, pests, and disease.
His ideas of centers of diversity and origin pointed the way to future geneticists and plant breeders as to the areas where they should concentrate their efforts in looking for new characters which they didn't have already.
By the mid-30s, Vavilov was widely recognized as the world's greatest geneticist. A steady stream of foreign visitors came to see him in Leningrad.
Oh, he was a larger-than-life character, extremely charming and friendly, treated me, a young graduate student, as I were an honored colleague of many years standing, which of course impressed me extremely.
In the eyes of the scientific world, Vavilov stood on a pedestal, but at home, he was in trouble.
He was not against the system, but the system was against him.
In the USSR, the science of genetics was under attack. Tropim Lysenko, a biologist, convinced Stalin that Vavilov's activities were wasted effort, that there were quicker ways to improve Soviet agriculture. Lysenko claimed, for example, that if seeds were soaked in cold water before planting, their offspring could acquire the ability to survive in colder climates.
Lysenko was a charlatan. He stood for fiction. Fictions, but fictions that was beloved by Stalin and his entourage. Because he promised miracles in agriculture.
Vavilov and his assistants defended genetics against Lysenko's bizarre theories, receiving Stalin's wrath in return.
Every day we were coming to work and we just knew that somebody is arrested. Today this professor, the next day another one.
In 1940, Vavilov himself was arrested by the secret police and charged with being an enemy of the state. In prison, he was interrogated and tortured.
Night after night after night after night, 1700 hours. And then he was sentenced to death.
In August of 1941, only a year after Vavilov's arrest, the German army attacked Leningrad and blockaded the city. By fall, supplies started running out. By winter, the ration of bread had been cut to 4 ounces a day.
German pilots swooped down and bombed us. There were stashes of sugar, and when they were bombing, everything burned up. The sugar melted into the dirt, and so we ate the dirt.
It was one of the most bitter winters in the city's history, with the temperature falling to 40 degrees below zero. 600,000 citizens of Leningrad died of starvation. At Mavilov's Institute, the scientists worked desperately to protect their seeds.
Many people knew of the Institute and that there was a lot of seed and grain here. The scientists were terribly afraid that starving people might try to break into the building.
Then, as conditions grew steadily worse, Babilov's colleagues faced a devil's choice: boil and eat the seeds, or starve to death.
You have to imagine the situation. War, Germans, these hungry people, hundreds of thousands, dying in streets and danger. They themselves, their families, have no food, but they use these seeds. They are priceless.
First, Dr. Dmitry Ivanov, director of the rice collection, died at his desk.
What could last even more?
When he died and the people opened his room, they found Dr. Ivanov dead from hunger, with all his collection of rice around him in the same room, and even on his table.
One by one, nine scientists, surrounded by tons of edible seeds, perished from hunger, thus saving the seeds that would have saved them. The defense of Leningrad lasted for 900 days, leaving a million dead and the city in ruins. The area around the seed bank, though, was spared from the bombing because Hitler had planned a victory celebration at the adjacent Astoria Hotel. And what finally of Nikolai Vavilov? Though his death sentence was commuted, the man whose discoveries had helped feed millions of people starved to death in prison on January 26, 1943. The Russian scientists sacrificed their lives because they understood the
quite an experience, of course, being at that place and interviewing these older people who had been part of this and had been Vavilov's colleagues and who had survived themselves. There were limited amounts of food, so not everybody died, and there were probably 50 scientists left, and nine of them perished. Others came very close, but for other ways, their families had food or something like that. The interesting thing is that this seed bank, the biggest still in the world, the second biggest is now in the United States in Fort Collins, Colorado. It's the national seed laboratory in Fort Collins. It's the best. I mean, we have very, very good equipment and money and refrigeration and things for the seeds in the National Seed Storage Laboratory in Fort Collins. But it's not the big. The biggest collection is still in St. Petersburg now, but it has fallen into total disrepair since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Money basically just was no longer being put into this kind of science. And so when we were there in 1993, we could see the bottles and the things with seeds filling up with mold, all of the computer, the various systems falling apart. It was really sort of staggering to see. And it's improved a little since we were there, but only because the whole bottom of these two major buildings in St. Petersburg, which housed the world's greatest seed bank, the two bottom floors have now been turned into, the seed banks rent the space for what are now very expensive boutiques selling to the elite, various things to the new elite in St. Petersburg. And that is really the only money that provides and allows the seed bank to continue, in addition to some aid from the West and some aid from the United States. We did send a number of computers
and other things there, but it's kind of a bad situation. And so it's sort of interesting that this place that these scientists gave their lives for these seeds has kind of collapsed more out of disinterest.
So yes. How did you come to make this particular one?
The film, the idea was brought to me by a fellow who had actually founded a company for saving these sort of heirloom seeds, a company called Seeds of Change, and who was doing a book on this subject. And I got funding to do it from the Ford Foundation, and founded a, you know, when I first, I'd never heard of this. I didn't know anything about these seeds. There's incidentally, the best and most significant seed-saving organization in the United States today is based in Decorah, Iowa, where probably close to where some of you come from. It's called the Seed Savers Exchange. A fellow named Kent Wheely started that some years ago. And is there a Luther College there, too? I think there is, yeah. But I found the subject fascinating when I looked into it, and more fascinating. And one of the ironies is that when this film showed on PBS, and it was showed in San Francisco, it was seen by a woman who gave me a call and left me a message on my machine at Channel 9 in Seattle saying, I saw your film, and my father met, in fact, his whole life was changed by a chance meeting he had as a young man with Nikolai Vavilov, the Russian scientist. And my father is now, had become the leading potato expert in the world, and is leading the fight now to save potatoes from a new outbreak, much more virulent outbreak of the blight that caused the Irish potato famine, which is creating havoc for potatoes all around the world. So we are now chemicalizing potatoes like crazy in order to be able to grow them in the face of this blight. Well, it turned out, she left this message for me, and it turned out I was in San Francisco at the time. These little things happen. I was about to fly back to Seattle in a couple of hours, and I checked my messages, got this message, and she had left the number, and it was a 415 area code, which I knew was the San Francisco area. So I thought, somebody here in San Francisco. I hadn't even known it was on San Francisco TV the night before. So I thought I'd call. So I called her, and she said, well, where are, she said, well, why don't we meet? And I said, well, I have to go to the airport. I'm on my way to the airport to fly back to Seattle. And she said, well, where are you? And I told her, is that a motel in the marina in San Francisco? And she said, well, I'm six blocks away from you. I'll come right over and bring you all this stuff about my father. And she did, and it was a stack of stuff about this new potato blight, which I hadn't heard of, and about her father's work and how he won the World Food Prize, which is the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for agriculture work. And I said, and where is your father? And she said, well, he's a retired professor at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Well, these kind of things happen, and it, as it turned out, I hadn't been in Tucson before, but I was going there 3 days later. So 3 days later, literally 3 days later, in a hotel in Tucson, I was meeting this guy. And he told me all the story, and I'll show you a little bit of this on Thursday, the story of how he encountered Vavilov as a young man, sort of a chance, a malark trip that he made to the Soviet Union in 1935, when you really weren't supposed to go there. Mm-hmm. And it changed his whole life and led him into the path that he's followed since then. So, and that just came about from people seeing this program. And that frequently happens, that I told one of the staff people here who asked me like, where do your ideas come from? I said, well, I haven't had an original idea in 10 years. They all come to me from other people who see shows on the air, and then they say, well, please, you should do this. And literally, I'm really hearing from somebody about every other day with a new idea of something they think I ought to make into a TV show. And of course, most of them are bad ideas, but there are a lot more good ideas than I could possibly do, and I really feel bad that I can't do more of them. But some of them do turn out, and sometimes people call, not only say, I've got an idea for you, but I know where you might be able to find some funding for it, and that makes it a little bit easier, because as you might guess, these things are not cheap.
Do you remember the worst idea?
Oh, geez, I don't know. I shouldn't do this. Usually the ideas are not, they're not terrible ideas in the sense that the subject matter isn't terrible, but they're things that don't easily at all translate to television. Or they're historical things for which there's absolutely no photographs or footage or anything like that. You know, they're things that just, they're not bad ideas per se, but they're bad television ideas. They just don't translate into TV. That's what more frequently happens. They may be actually quite remarkable stories, but they just don't. Fortunately for this, and of course we didn't know this when we contacted the Russians at the Institute, we didn't know that the Russians had, that they would have all this film footage of the siege of Leningrad to give us, which they did, or that they would have this great photographic collection. All those photographs of Vavilov were, that you saw, were hidden for a long period of time by his colleagues and followers, because it really was not kosher, so to speak, to have anything related to Vavilov during Stalin's lifetime, and even for some time afterwards. So the Vavilov's followers had hidden that, these kinds of things, until Vavilov in the mid-1960s, largely through the efforts of Sakharov, was rehabilitated, and people really recognized the fact that Sakharov said, this is really the greatest scientist in Russian history, and he's been kind of hidden. And at that, and this Trofim Lysenko, charlatan and crazy man that he was, still had enormous power in Russia until through the 1960s. And Lysenko actually was still working in an official position, and nothing really bad ever happened to Lysenko, except that he did lose credibility with other scientists. But he died in 1976, Lysenko, and still was, he still had quite a following, in fact. And he was a very interesting man, a man for whom, you read his life story, and it's an interesting one to me. It shows me how the different things that can motivate people. By all accounts, Trofim Lysenko was one of the most generous human beings in the world. He had absolutely no interest whatsoever in material gains or possession. Throughout his entire life, he basically lived in a room with a suitcase. He was married. His wife always complained that they never had anything. Lysenko was always giving things away to people. So he had no greed for stuff, which is sort of the common American greed, but he had tremendous greed for power. This was it. It was like to be in control and to be in that. It says something, I think, about psychology. And Vavilov himself, according to all accounts, was also an immensely generous individual. And his passion was science. And his passion was feeding the world, and he didn't have, and he really didn't know how to fight back. He just didn't understand until too late. In fact, early on, he helped Lysenko in his career because he thought Lysenko was a promising young scientist, and Lysenko had a few early good ideas that Vavilov liked, but soon, in time, Vavilov realized what Lysenko really was and spoke out against him. By that time, it only worked to get Vavilov in prison and put away. So, and it's the story of the two. There are several books written by Russian authors but translated into English about Vavilov and Lysenko. And Russian television actually made a 13-part dramatic series called Vavilov and Lysenko about this sort of titanic struggle between science on the one hand and ideology on the other, almost like Galileo and the Pope or something like that. But I think that also is a lesson about not being too fanatical about things. And apparently, the guy who played Lysenko was sufficiently slimy that he won the equivalent of the Soviet Academy Award for his performance in this television drama. Anyway, if there's any other questions, also if people want to see any of these films in their entirety, you can just talk to me about it and I can loan them to you to look at next door at times during the day and so forth. Yes?
Coming back to the Japanese internment and the Coeur d'Alene episode, were not the ACLU involved in the first and the Southern Poverty Law Center involved in the second?
The Southern Poverty Law Center was, yes, involved in the second. The ACLU was involved later on in the internment. The ACLU's position initially during internment was not particularly
helpful.
And lawyers, the only organization that was really strongly supportive of Japanese Americans at that time was the American Plant Students Committee. They put money in it. The ACLU did come around and did join Friend of the Court briefs in opposing this by 1944, but by that time things had changed in the country. And remember, there were many very good liberal people who supported this. I think Justice William O. Douglas, for one, looked back on this as the great mistake of his political life. He supported it in the Supreme Court. And, you know, the court, with the exception of one Justice, Frank Murphy, the former governor of Michigan, the Supreme Court simply backed this, you know, when it occurred. And that was not overturned until some 40 years later, when the courts ruled that the internment had been unconstitutional in the case of Gordon Hirabayashi, who was a Seattle Japanese-American who fought the internment at the time. Anyway, thank you all.